and welcome back to the Chemical Watch News and Insight Podcast, part of the broader suite of intelligence offerings from Inhesa. And the podcast is hosted by members of the Chemical Watch News and Insight team, where we aim to provide you with fresh insights into the developments taking place in the world of chemicals management. I'm Terry Hyland, Senior Editor at Chemical Watch, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the first of three special editions of the News and Insight podcast. We'll go behind the headlines of our 2024 Global Outlook series of articles and explore what's in store for the year ahead. And for today's episode, I'm joined by our North America Desk Editor, Julia John, Transport and Storage Managing Editor, Peter McKay, and Europe Managing Editor, Lee Stringer. And today we'll begin in the U.S. with an update on the regulation of PFAS at both the national and state levels. And we'll follow that with an update on key developments this year in transport and storage regulations across the globe. And finally, we'll dive into international environmental policy developments out of the U.N. But like I said, first, let's start with PFAS regulations in the U.S. In the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency is now in the final year of its four-year PFAS roadmap, which laid out an agenda for more PFAS testing, reporting, and tougher reviews under the TSCA New Chemicals Program. This year will also see the start of reporting under the new PFAS reporting rule. And beyond the federal government, several U.S. states are forging their own path, implementing or crafting rules that will restrict PFAS in different products, or eventually phase out non-essential uses of the class of chemicals entirely. So Julia, let's start with you, and we'll focus first on the federal government. What can we expect from the US EPA over the next 12 months or so as the agency works to gather information on existing PFAS compounds and tighten reviews of new ones and new uses?
Thanks, Terry, and hi, everyone. So this year, the EPA is working to complete key objectives laid out in its PFAS roadmap. For example, 2024 will probably bring more TSCA Section 4 test orders under the agency's National PFAS Testing Strategy, on top of the three orders we've seen so far since 2022. The EPA is actually expanding the strategy by incorporating a fit-for-purpose PFAS definition now used by the agency's Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics. This could add 20 chemical groupings to capture approximately 13,500 compounds, signaling the development of more test orders than the two dozen that were initially planned. Also, as you mentioned, the EPA will open the submission period for its one-time TSCA Section 8A7 PFAS reporting rule on the 12th of November. Manufacturers must detail their use of over 1,460 compounds stretching back to 2011, with no exemptions for small businesses or article importers. In a webinar last week, the agency said it'll provide a Q&A resource to address stakeholders' many remaining questions about requirements and give them the chance to become familiar with and test the reporting portal. The EPA intends to set the stage for more reporting under the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, with a February proposal to add more PFAS to the Toxics Release Inventory Reporting Program. The agency aims to finalize the listings by November. Combined with a recent rule naming roughly 200 of the listed PFAS as chemicals of special concern that require annual reporting for even minor emissions, as well as downstream supplier notifications, the additions seek to boost public awareness of PFAS uses and releases. And the EPA also intends to keep proposing catch-up significant new use rules, or SNRs, on 150 PFAS that were allowed onto the market, subject to controls on their original pre-manufacturer notice filers. The SNRs would extend those TSCA Section 5E order conditions to other manufacturers and block further uses without prior notification to and permission from the agency. It has so far only proposed 35 of these catch-up SNRs, which was in late 2022. Moreover, some attorneys think the EPA will make it nearly impossible for any new PFAS to get approval under the agency's recently adopted PFAS assessment framework and proposal to no longer exempt them from 90-day pre-market reviews. That latter TSCA new chemicals framework proposal is scheduled for finalization by April.
Thanks, Julia. Definitely a lot going on at the federal level, but federal action on PFAS is not the only part of the U.S. picture. Washington State is poised to restrict use of the compounds in a host of products, while states like Maine and Minnesota are implementing even more sweeping laws that could restrict most PFAS uses in those states within the next decade. So what is the regulatory view from the states?
Yeah, there's a lot happening at the state level as well. So in Maine, manufacturers have until the next new year to provide information on PFAS-containing items sold in the state, following recent amendments to its first-in-the-nation 2021 statute to eliminate all non-essential PFAS applications by decade's end. Industry has until the 1st of March to submit currently unavoidable use, or CUU, proposals for exemptions from the 2030 phase-out. The state plans to issue a revised draft rule this spring to clarify the disclosure requirements. A final rule will reflect any further legislative changes enacted this year, as lawmakers may revisit a previous bill to refine the reporting scheme and ban specific product categories as part of the overarching prohibition. Meanwhile, Minnesota is working to draft rules for a similar PFAS scheme, including disclosure requirements, related fees, and criteria for CUUs it'll exclude from its 2032 PFAS phase-out. Minnesota's CUU consultation also ends on the 1st of March. The underlying 2023 state law restricts 11 PFAS-containing goods starting on the 1st of January 2025, including unprecedented bans on menstrual articles, dental floss, clean products, and cookware. And moving west, under the Safer Products for Washington program, a final report is due in June to guide prohibitions on PFAS-containing items for which state regulators have found safer alternatives. In December, the State Environmental Department released a draft report to the legislature recommending restrictions on cleaners and most clothing. The document also suggested disclosure mandates for kitchenware, shoes, gear, specialized outdoor sportswear, firefighting personal protective equipment, floor waxes and polishes, automotive and ski waxes, and hard surface sealants. During the inaugural cycle of the Green Chemistry Scheme, the state finalized a regulation banning PFAS-containing carpets, rugs, and aftermarket treatments from the 1st of January next year. The rule also imposes reporting obligations for PFAS-containing outdoor textile furnishings from then onwards. And across the country, state prohibitions on an assortment of PFAS-containing articles enter into force in the coming year. For instance, food packaging restrictions are slated to take effect in Washington State, Hawaii, and Oregon, adding to several recently established state bans. And on the 1st of January 2025, cosmetic prohibitions kick off in California, Washington State, Colorado, and Maryland. New York and California will simultaneously see restrictions for everyday apparel, and the latter's will be coupled with a PFAS warning mandate for clothing designed for severely wet settings. Firefighting foam bans will also begin in Illinois and Hawaii by then.
Right. Thank you, Julia. That's a great and very full overview of the many requirements to look for this year. So what do these actions mean for enforcement at the federal level from agencies like the EPA or for litigation involving the various PFAS requirements across the U.S.?
Yeah, good question. So 2024 is anticipated to usher in greater enforcement action around PFAS, which the EPA has actually prioritized as a national enforcement and compliance initiative. According to one legal expert, once the agency finalizes its drinking water standards for 6 PFAS and Superfund hazardous substance designations for 2, which will likely happen early this year, The agency will undertake enforcement efforts targeting companies considered to be substantial contributors to PFAS pollution. The PFOA and PFOS hazardous substance designations could prompt a cascade of lawsuits demanding remediation funds from anyone connected to PFAS contamination at a Superfund site, including the compound's downstream users. The EPA could also pursue PFAS manufacturers and others subject to TSCA chemical data reporting requirements, both for violating those duties and for contributing to PFAS pollution. So the risk faced by industry is extensive because the substance class is so broadly used.
Indeed. Yep. Thanks again, Julia. As usual, there is no shortage of developments when it comes to PFAS. Now, let's turn to transportation and storage of dangerous goods. Many U.S. listeners are familiar with the phrase, one if by land, two if by sea, from Longfellow's famous poem, Paul Revere's Ride. But we may need extra lanterns to warn us of the coming regulatory changes for moving goods by land, sea, and air. Peter, we can expect to see continued work on the UN model regulations this year. In addition, entities shipping hazardous materials via ship or air may also have some updates to consider. Can you walk us through the regulatory developments for air and maritime transport, as well as the ongoing work on the UN model regulations?
Sure thing, Terry. Thanks for that introduction. Firstly, those involved in the transport of dangerous goods by sea or air have already seen some changes this year. The 65th edition of the IATA Dangerous Goods Regulations took effect promptly on January the 1st, as it does every year. This was a comparatively minor update, really, but it does include some important changes for those shipping lithium batteries by air. And those involved in the transport of packaged dangerous goods by sea, and packaged dangerous goods includes tank containers. For them, Amendment 4122 to the IMDG code became mandatory on January the 1st. But as this has been available for use since the start of 2023 and is based on the 22nd revised edition of the UN model regulations, most shippers and carriers should be well aware of the changes, I should think. But dangerous goods regulations never stop. The UN Subcommittee of Experts on the Transport of Dangerous Goods held two sessions last year and will hold another two this year in order to finalise the amendments that are scheduled to be adopted by the parent UN Committee of Experts. And that will appear in the 24th revised edition of the UN model regulations. That should be published early in 2025. The most significant changes that have already been agreed revolve around the transport of lithium cells and batteries. This is a constant area of change, but also other energy storage devices, particularly sodium ion cells and batteries, and also liquid organic hydrogen carriers, LOHCs, other bio-based alternatives to fossil fuels and liquefied hydrogen and carbon dioxide. As the world moves away from hydrocarbon-based energy sources, regulators are having to deal with the different hazards posed by these alternatives, and to do so in the face of rapid technological developments. Quite often we find that the regulators are actually trying to catch up with industry. This UN subcommittee is also revisiting some recent amendments, including those related to FRP tanks. And it's also engaged in its constant struggle to keep the regulations understandable and tidy.
Thanks, Peter. And yeah, interesting point on the regulators trying to chase the technological developments. That's interesting. So now let's turn to Europe. And I have a two-part question for you. So what's on the horizon for the main EU regulations on the carriage of goods by rail, road, and inland waterways? And how might, or even will, the packaging and packaging waste regulation affect requirements for hazardous transport of goods, or transport of hazardous goods, that is?
Well, the regulatory bodies in Europe, like the other international nodal organizations, are busy at the moment transposing the amendments that were contained in the 23rd revised edition of the UN model regulations into their own rule books. And that process will continue until around the middle of this year. There's a lot of meetings scheduled for the second quarter, for instance, and they'll be hoping to get everything finished so that the revised regulations can be published later in the year, allowing industry to have time to get used to them before the regulations start taking effect from the beginning of 2025. The changes in that 23rd edition of the UN model regulations are many and various, but a brief summary of the major amendments includes a number of new UN numbers and provisions regulating the transport of sodium ion batteries, fire suppressant dispersing devices, disilane, gallium containing articles, and trifluoromethyl tetrazole sodium salt in acetone. There's a tightening of the transport conditions for tetramethyl ammonium hydroxide, including the creation of a UN number for concentrations of not less than 25%. And a lot of changes to the transport provisions for battery-powered vehicles, including the creation of three new UN numbers. That's quite a high-profile change now after a number of fires during transport. There's an exception for the transport of cells or batteries from short production runs, etc. A new special provisions to increase the authorised volume for transport in limited quantities of some compressed gases of Division 2.2 without subsidiary hazards. That was a direct response to a request from industry, in fact. And there's an exemption for nitrocellulose membrane filters used in rapid medical test devices. And a clarification concerning pharmaceutical products that are packed in a form ready to be administered. And again, and we find this increasingly, seeing as most of the regulatory bodies are ultimately agencies of the United Nations and are following the UN Sustainable Development Goals, there's an update on the requirements for the use of recycled plastics in packaging. There are other changes that don't derive from the UN model regulations. And for instance, under ADR, the regulations governing the transport of dangerous goods by road in Europe and increasingly elsewhere, a number of new provisions have just been agreed that will allow the use of battery electric, fuel cell and hydrogen powered vehicles as AT and FL vehicles under ADR for the transport of dangerous goods as from 2025. There's also been several changes to the regulations governing the transport of chemical wastes. The problem being that while if you're producing new chemicals, you know what they contain, what their properties are. With chemical wastes, the waste streams are seldom consistent. So the waste industry has problems in complying. you did mention the new draft packaging and packaging waste regulation that was published last year. The idea being to replace the existing directive in the EU. The initial draft threatened really the position of the packaging recycling and reconditioning sector in particular. And after some heavy duty lobbying, I have to say, by packaging associations. The most recent draft of the planned regulation exempts from its coverage industrial packagings approved for the transport of dangerous goods. Still, that may yet change.
Yes, as you said before, Peter, constant change through all the regulations. And now we will hop across the pond to North America, but sticking with you, Peter. In the U.S., we have the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, working to bring rulemaking in line with international requirements and continuing to deal with the fallout from the Ohio train derailment and fire last February. In Canada, that country is working on an update to its dangerous goods regulations. So from your view, what are the biggest things to watch in North America?
Well, yes, as you pointed out, PHMSA is paddling hard to keep up. It's a notice of proposed rulemaking under HM215Q, which is its latest biennial international harmonization, was published only at the end of May last year. And we haven't yet seen the final rule. But there has been a notice of enforcement discretion. So if you're in the States or subject to the hazardous materials regulations and you are applying the updated air and sea regulations, you're not going to be penalised. There are a number of other outstanding proposals from PHMSA, and potentially the largest of these, I think, is HM265A, which was published in July last year and sought to solicit stakeholder feedback on the initiatives PHMSA is considering to modernise the hazardous materials regulations and improve efficiencies while maintaining or improving a current high level of safety. It sought in particular comments on a list of 46 different topics, many of which were originally generated in response to an invitation issued by the Office of Secretary of Transportation as far back as October 2017. The last time I looked, there were something over 60 comments on this advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. And it'll clearly take some time for these to be filtered down into formal proposals. But I think there will be some action later this year. there was, yes, that derailment and fire in Ohio about a year ago now, which, considering it didn't have much impact on the people or the environment at the time, has had a big knock-on effect. PHMSA and the Federal Railroad Administration issued a range of safety advisories in the aftermath, including encouraging a faster phase-out of legacy rail tank cars. This is something that's been going on for several years, in fact, and they're trying to get it accelerated. Urging railroad companies to improve their emergency preparedness. The National Transportation Safety Board released a preliminary report back in last February and held a hearing in June, but hasn't yet announced a release date for its final report. It's quite possible that could come this year, which may involve also recommendations to PHMSA and the Federal Railroad Administration. There's a couple of big changes in Canada. The biggest one recently was the introduction by Transport Canada of its client identification database. Transport Canada had it pointed out to it that actually had no idea how many entities in Canada were actually handling dangerous goods. And so they're now going around getting industry to sign up for this. it's Transport Canada has also published proposals for a broad update to the transportation of dangerous goods regulations. There's a consultation period on the proposal due to end on the 22nd of February. This is quite an interesting rulemaking. It brings together a lot of ideas to strengthen the existing rules and clarify positions, etc. Get rid of a lot of outdated provisions. In particular, Transport Canada are aiming to make changes that means that stakeholders won't have to apply anymore for equivalency certificates. That'll be a benefit both for the regulated industry and for Transport Canada itself. And there's another smaller proposal from Transport Canada to introduce registration fees for facilities that design and manufacture containers for the transport of dangerous goods. That's expected to come into force later this year.
Right. Thank you, Peter. Certainly no shortage of action in North America either. And I'll add that that Ohio train derailment could have, or seems to already be having, even broader regulatory implications outside of transport. And we may hear more about that in a future podcast with our in weeks when we talk about TSCA developments on the horizon. But for now, we'll say thank you very much, Peter. And I will put down my lanterns, designating land, sea, or otherwise. And we'll move on to the UN, where the issue of pollution is driving a greater focus on chemicals of concern. So Lee, turning to you, the sixth session of the UN Environment Assembly is set to start late next month, late in February. Why is this? Actually, I'm going to start that paragraph over since this might not publish or go live until February. So sorry, Cameron. Sorry for the interruption. I'll start again. So Lee, we will turn to you. The sixth session of the UN Environment Assembly is set to start in late February. And why is this an important forum to watch? And what can we expect to see flow from the Assembly's meeting?
Yes, thanks, Terry. Certainly a busy year for the international environmental agenda, and none more so than the very important UNEA 6 that's coming up and being held on the 26th of February to the 1st of March at the UN Environment Programme headquarters in Nairobi, Kenya. Now, the Assembly has a membership of all 193 member states, and through its resolutions and calls to action, it sets the global environmental agenda, it provides overarching policy guidance, and it defines policy responses to address emerging environmental challenges. So it's considered the world's highest level decision-making body on the environment. And this year's assembly, which they take place every 2 years, will be an important one for chemicals for a number of reasons. And the first one is that one of the three planetary crises identified by the UN is pollution. And that goes alongside climate change and biodiversity loss. And under this pollution pillar, chemicals production, use and management, of course, are key areas of concern. So the overall theme for UNEA 6 is effective, inclusive and sustainable multilateral actions to tackle climate change, biodiversity loss and pollution. And several areas of global action to address chemicals are set to be discussed. So the first of these are the Global Framework for Chemicals, which was agreed in September last year. And this sets out a worldwide plan for how to eliminate the human health and environmental issues associated with chemicals. The Assembly will discuss how to raise awareness and progress of the goals and objectives of the framework over the coming years. The Global Framework for Chemicals preceded the strategic approach to international chemicals management. Both are voluntary, so global framework for chemicals remains voluntary, but many consider the new framework more ambitious because of the more specific objectives, goals, and set timelines as well, which were often missing from its predecessor. So that's the first. The other area is the treaty to address plastics pollution, which is also on the agenda. And this holds many considerations for the material itself, but also plastic additives that are used in them. And I'll come more onto the treaty negotiations shortly. And lastly, the Assembly will also look at plans to establish a science policy panel for chemicals and waste, which is also being discussed, and plans drawn up for who will be selected and how it will operate. So there's some areas of contention here. There's been many scientists from around the world saying that industry experts with potential conflicts of interest should be limited to observer status of the panel and certainly not participate directly in discussions. Now, to what extent industry will be involved in the panel has and will be a key topic of discussion since the idea was first discussed, and I'm sure it will be the discussion will continue into the open-ended working group, the third meeting, which will be held on the 17th to the 21st of June in Switzerland. There's also a number of discussions happening throughout the week, obviously around climate change and biodiversity loss and other areas. But it's generally encouraged that all stakeholders from industry to the public all engage in the process and keep an eye on the outcomes as the Assembly. It will drive policy and action, including regulatory action at a more granular level.
Thank you, Lee. And you had mentioned the Global Plastics Treaty. And this spring, we'll see the fourth round of negotiations toward that treaty. Can you tell us a little bit about a little bit more and then the potential implications once a treaty is potentially finalized?
Yes, that's right, Terry. So obviously a significant global discussion, as you can imagine. The plastics pollution issue has been one of the most pressing ones that's really penetrating the public's minds. And of course, largely because it's such a visual problem. We're seeing swathes of plastic washing up on shores around the world and other quite visual things that we're seeing creating quite a storm of trying to solve the issue. Stakeholders are calling it one of the most important environmental agreements since the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. And the aim of the global treaty to address plastics pollution is to create a legally binding instrument that addresses the full life cycle of plastic, including its production, design and disposal. So we're not just talking about the waste that's ending up at the end. It's really looking at the full life cycle. And we're in the middle of the negotiations. The third round of the talks took place in November last year in Nairobi. And due to the awareness and the global concern, stakeholders and countries involved are wanting to get this done quickly, and it's aimed to be finalised next year. But what does it mean? Well, there are strong measures being floated, and if they're agreed, the treaty will have significant implications for not only plastic producers, but plastic additives manufacturers, as well as all sectors along the supply chain that use plastics. And most notably, and the areas that are being most hotly debated are proposals to set caps on plastic production, specific caps, and also global bans on certain chemicals of concern that are often used in the materials. And on this latter point, it's interesting because we have the voluntary global framework on chemicals. But this, of course, will be a treaty and legally binding. So any chemicals of concern that are listed will be something that all countries will need to abide by. So both areas are becoming significant aspects of the negotiations. So with all this in mind, we have the fourth round of negotiations taking place from the 23rd to the 29th of April in Canada. And some stakeholders are hoping for more progress because there's been quite a lot of criticism, mainly from NGOs who have mainly blamed a group of what they're calling oil producing countries for slowing the process down in the previous three rounds of the talks. So this latest set of negotiations will be a key point of call to the outcomes of the treaty.
Thanks. Yeah, good to see what happens this year as the final text comes more into focus. And we started off this podcast with PFAS, which have dominated a lot of chemical news headlines in recent years. But I have a feeling we could see the word plastic more and more in the future. But news about PFAS, much like the persistent compounds themselves, is not going to go away anytime soon. And long-chain PFAS are expected to be added to the Stockholm Convention's list of chemicals to be eliminated, along with certain chlorinated paraffins. So on that theme, Lee, can you tell us what to expect from the conventions, from the POPs review committee later this year?
Yes, yeah, so going from the plans to create a brand new treaty to one that's been around for quite a long time with the Stockholm Convention, this year we'll see further consideration to add medium chain chlorinated paraffins, or MCCPs, and long chain perfluorocarboxylic acids, or LCPFCAs, to the list of chemicals to be eliminated under the convention on persistent organic pollutants. So both groups of substances were recommended for inclusion at the last meeting of the convention's POPs review committee, or POPRC, and that took place in October last year. Just a little note on the substances themselves. So MCCPs are primarily used as plasticizers in polyvinyl chloride, or PVC, as well as extreme pressure additives in metal working fluids, or MWFs, rubber, adhesives, sealants, and paints. And for LCPFCAs, they can be intentionally used in a range of applications, including electronic articles, medical and laboratory devices, food contact materials, and paints. But in addition, they may also be unintentionally produced during the manufacture of other PFASs and in other industrial processes. So the POPRC said the most efficient control measure for these would be to include them in Annex A of the convention. And if this is approved, such a listing would require signatory nations to take measures to ban the chemicals' production, use, import, and export, subject to potential exemptions. And of course, exemptions is an interest to industry, and experts have acknowledged that more work is needed on a number of outstanding issues, including specifying the proposed exemptions, ahead of a final vote at the Conference of the Parties at the Stockholm Convention that will be happening next year. And all this means there will be an opportunity at the next POPRC meeting, which is happening between the 23rd to the 27th of September this year, to introduce addendums to the suggested bans.
Yes, all right. Thank you, Lee, for that important global view. And thank you again to all of our fantastic speakers, to Julia, Peter, and again, Lee, for sharing your insights into the key developments to watch in 2024. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We hope you found this discussion valuable. Our 2024 Global Outlook series of articles can be found at the Chemical Watch News and Insight website, which is at product.inhesa.com/news-insight. And we hope you can join us again in 2 weeks for part two of our Global Outlook podcast. And until then, goodbye.